But then, about an hour later, the invisible waves pumping down from the onboard radars began to hit something different. Metal structures such as sheds or rails have great numbers of loose electrons. Tree leaves in brick buildings and paved roads have fewer, but transmit some signals as well. The oscilloscopes, 2 miles high, began to reveal a sharp contrast with the blackness of the sea. The Pathfinder planes at the front realized they were crossing the coast and made slight corrections to be exactly on course. More than 700 bombers followed close behind. The bombing crews started expelling the confetti-like bundles of chaff from the planes. The bundles blew apart in the fast-moving air, separating into thousands of aluminum strips as they fell. The invisible waves that the Würzburg and other sets were spraying upward slammed into all the loose electrons in the slowly fluttering aluminum. As the aluminum's loose outer electrons moved back and forth under that unstoppable power from below, they became miniature transmitters. The sky was still pitch black to human eyes, but for each radar set below, it glowed bright as each aluminum strip began broadcasting. Millions of identical signals rained down. The Würzburg and other radars were swamped. No ground controller could pick out the actual airplanes in that dazzling electric power. The searchlights they had controlled suddenly began spinning aimlessly. Anti-aircraft batteries either stopped operating or fired randomly. Fighter pilots called down frantically for directions. Some of the ground controllers in such circumstances yelled into their radios for the fighters to break off, the bombers are multiplying themselves. Others sent angry radio messages up, telling the fighter pilots to fly twisting flight paths in an attempt to have them stand out from the multiplying aluminum transmissions that filled the sky. None of it worked. The RAF planes were now unopposed. High explosives were dropped first to pierce the water mains. A later count showed that they had broken in over 2,000 places, and to break open the houses below. Bricks were shattered and fragments blew apart. Then the main bomb doors opened, releasing the chemical incendiaries. Fires began, and the flames joined together, and then the whole city ignited. People tried to escape, but how? One 15-year-old girl remembered. Mother wrapped me in wet sheets, kissed me, and said, "Run." I hesitated at the door, but then I ran out to the street. I never saw her again. An older girl, 19, joined a group trying to get across the large boulevard of the Eiferstrasse, but at the last moment she realized she had to stop. The heat of the fires was making the street melt. She recalled, "There were people on the roadway, alive but stuck on the asphalt. They must have rushed onto the roadway without thinking. Their feet had got stuck, and they'd put out their hands to get out again. They were on their hands and knees, screaming." Up above, a captain in one of the Pathfinder squadrons, at age 27, older than almost every other pilot, looked down at the storm that had been a living city. "Those poor bastards," he muttered over the radio. He pushed his hands on the steering control, and the great plane began to turn. Insulated wires in his cockpit guided electrons along copper strands as indications of the wings dipping appeared on his cockpit displays. Faraday's waves flooded in through his thick glass windshield. Some broadcast invisibly from the thousands of fluttering aluminum strips in the air. Others broadcast visibly, painfully so, from the glaring flames. A final glance, and his Lancaster bomber swung away. The single night's attack was over, but the bombing would continue on and off for another 2 years. The attack was shattering, yet all that horror and struggle, the Chain Homes defenses, as well as the Hamburg-destroying war machines, only skims the surface of what electrical effects can produce. For there's yet another level that goes beyond the image of powerful waiting electric charges, beyond even the invisible, space-crossing waves that can force those charges to move. The vision that Maxwell had of atoms was incomplete. In the 1910s and 1920s, even before Watson Watt found himself in Slough, a small number of theorists had begun exploring this new, submicroscopic world. If they were right, then the world beneath our own is composed of electrons that travel in abrupt, teleporting jumps, known as quantum jumps, and also in sudden stops and starts. This would change everything, for electrons are central to electricity. And whenever we discover something new about them, the groundwork is laid for a fresh technology. In late Victorian times, the vision of electrons as hard little balls led to the technology of telephones, light bulbs, and electric motors. Faraday's and Hertz's understanding of waves had led to radio and radar, which were so central to World War II. Now the realization that electrons could dematerialize, that they could in effect pop through space and be made to start and stop in fresh places, would open the way for yet another device, a thinking machine, which would shape our era as much as electric lighting and telephones had shaped the 19th century. In the 1920s, the English word computer and its cognate in other languages still meant a person, usually female, who spent laborious hours at a desk using a mechanical calculator, or even old-fashioned pencil and paper, to compute whatever dull arithmetical task was assigned. It seemed impossible to go further, for if any genuine thinking machine were to match the quick flicks of human thought, it would need to shift its internal circuitry far faster than anyone could then imagine. No solid mechanical object could do that. But perhaps the wildly teleporting flights of tiny electrons could.